The creation of poetry is often a solitary thing. Your thoughts, your time to write them down, it is not frequently a team function. But being a poet is a little different from being the poet laureate of a state. That is the job currently held by Elizabeth Woody in Oregon. Governor Kate Brown appointed Elizabeth to the position last year, making her Oregon's first Native American poet laureate. That job is anything but solitary, as it takes her all over the state. She's in Ashland today to speak this afternoon at 4 at the Meese Room at the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University. And she's granting us some time here now. Elizabeth Woody, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you for the invitation.
Elizabeth was born on the reservation of the Navajo Nation in Arizona, member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, has lived in Oregon for a long time. Her first book of poetry, called Hand Into Stone, won the 1990 American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. Elizabeth also won the William Stafford Memorial Award for Poetry in 1995. Stafford himself, a former poet laureate of Oregon. So tell us what the feeling is like to be put in there with the likes of William Stafford on a very short list. I mean, I think 8 people have been poet laureate in Oregon.
It's an honor, for one. And the other is that I actually worked on the kind of like the committee that formed a new kind of description and definition of the poet laureate. I worked for years as, like you mentioned earlier, at EcoTrust, but I also served on boards and committees nationally, juries for poetry, literature, art. So they invited me as a kind of poet at large, somebody who could, from the field, to be part of that committee. So I am reaping the benefits of it. I can also say that there's some things I think that could be improved, and that is part of what I like about doing things.
Well, that is fun, though, because you get to set up the job description of what became a job you eventually got.
Yeah. Well, it's not a job. It's actually an appointment by the governor. And that in itself, I think, is probably the most important factor of it. Mm-hmm. You're representing the state and you're representing them by reputation, recognition. You go into places like I'm hoping to get into places like Ashland, farther away from Eugene and Portland, where all the writers seem to congregate and serve.
I noticed that. You talked about taking things way out there, too, the likes of Harney and Malheur County. Have you had a chance to get over there yet?
Yeah, no. I've been trying to work on my contacts. You know, most of the places that are way far out probably need more school contact and the schools are pretty much set. Sometimes it's hard to get into them, like in the middle of the year, unless you plan, you know, well ahead.
Oh, true. And you're getting close to the end of the school year now, too. And
yeah.
Lot of the extracurriculars are getting shed as the kids start lathering up for summer vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that we're clear up front. You do a lot of other things. You mentioned EcoTrust, and we can talk about that, and your work with CMOP and so many other boards and commissions. You are a painter as well. And I wonder if the arts ever cross, if some of the things that you have expressed, you express in both genres, both
sure.
in poetry and in painting.
Yeah, they have actually. I was a double major at the Institute of American Indian Arts
in Santa Fe.
Yeah, in Santa Fe. My initial kind of fascination or my focus was in photography, but then I started painting in high school, also pastel, and I love to draw. Actually, that's the basis of everything for art for me. And I worked for 12 years with my aunt Lillian Pitt in her studio as her studio manager. I was in charge of the production line. And then for maybe about 5 or 6 years, I collaborated with Joe Feddersen, who's a printmaker, and we did major installations all across the country. And so we did mixed media. We were Olympiads at the Atlanta, Georgia, during the Olympics. I've been part of touring exhibitions. So, yeah, they've always kind of intersected. More people know me as a poet and a writer than they do as an artist, but I do have a body of work.
And I read also that you provided the illustrations for another poet's collection for Sherman Alexie. I mean, what was that experience like?
Oh, it was fun. I mean, he called me up and wanted a list of artists, and I gave him a list of artists, and I told him that I did art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I drew and did all that. So he basically told me that he'd take a look at my stuff, and he picked me to be his illustrator. Which was, okay.
So much has been said about you being the first Native American poet laureate. It's important enough to mention for other people. What does it mean to you?
Well, I think when the announcement went out, there was all of these, you know, people who were making comments on the Kate Brown's, you know, website and other places. And one person said, oh, great, another non-Native Oregonian taking the poet laureate position, taking a literary position. Because most people migrate here to write. And
right.
They win all the awards in Oregon, but no Native Oregonians basically win it.
Mm-hmm.
They're all from someplace else. Everybody's from someplace else eventually when you get down to it. But I said, well, you know, my family's been here for over 14,000 years. I think I qualify as a native Oregonian. And we were citizens here before there was even an Oregon. So I had to, then he quit commenting.
Oh, no further comments from that particular
person.
No,
we didn't have a fight, which was not fun because it was supposed to be a fight, I thought.
No, you wanted to engage in one then, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to talk about that, but it didn't work.
Huh. Okay. So what does it mean to you? I mean, is it a great honor to be Poet Laureate, period, right?
Well, we have some really fantastic writers in the Northwest that are native, and they've been writing since, like, Mourning Dove, I think, was the first novelist in all of the United States. Sarah Winnemucca was also a published author. She was back in the turn of the century, in 1900s, and she was also a lobbyist. She'd go to Congress and lobby for the Burns Paiute people, trying to get them their homelands back. And, of course, you know, many times people think of Native American writers as kind of precocious, that we're kind of an unusual lot. But our literature is ancient and archived all across this country. The largest and most interesting body of literature that Del Himes talks about is the Wasco Chinookan collection.
Okay, much more to talk about with Elizabeth Woody, who's Oregon's Poet Laureate, and we'll come back and talk more with her, hear some of her poetry, and talk more about the process of taking poetry across the state of Oregon as Poet Laureate. If you'd like to see her in person, that's today at 4 at the Meese Room at the Hannon Library on the third floor of Southern Oregon University, on the third floor of the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Elizabeth Woody, and if you'd like to join us with your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're visiting once again with Oregon's Poet Laureate, but it's different from the last time we visited with Oregon's Poet Laureate because the position does shift every 2 years. Elizabeth Woody is right smack in the middle of her time as Oregon's Poet Laureate, Oregon's first Native American Poet Laureate, traveling the state, spreading poetry, spreading culture, and in Ashland this afternoon at 4 at the Meese Room at Southern Oregon University's Hannon Library. You can join the conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange about poetry, about culture, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So give us a sense, if you would, Elizabeth, about when you first started writing poetry and what motivated you the first time.
Well, people told me I wrote all my life. You know, basically I told stories. Then I started in high school doing photography, and that was my main focus. And then in the last year of high school, the English teacher had me enter the college prep English class, and then he decided that I should apply for this contest by the superintendent of Oregon called 12 High School Writers. And I didn't really think about entering it, and then it was like a couple days before the deadline. And I looked at the authors, and one of them was Sandra McPherson, who's a professor, former professor at UC Davis, and James Welch, who's a Gravant novelist who used to teach at University of Montana. And up to that point, I had read, you know, just the basic Native American authors, Leslie Marmon Silko and Scott Mamaday and Simon Ortiz. So I wanted to meet a Native author. So I wrote two poems. He sent them in, and I was selected to be one of 12 writers. And that was the year, that was actually... they got a letter from the state superintendent commending them on producing a fine writer like myself. But I was expelled from high school just before graduation.
Why?
Truancy.
Uh-huh.
You know, by definition.
You just hadn't been there enough?
Well, I was in the photo lab making my portfolio for my college entrance, you know, my portfolio for photography. So I hadn't made a deal with my teachers that I would turn in my work for a week in advance, and if it was a B or better, they'd write me a pass to the lab. So I would go in there all day because I had my day set up so I could spend most of my day there if I needed to. And it was senior year in high school, and most of us had all of our credit. I had all of my credits to graduate. But the vice principal he was a Hispanic guy, and he wanted to make an example of me. And my uncle and I went in to talk to him, and he said, you know, talk some sense into Elizabeth. She needs to apologize and do this and do that. And I said, no, I'm not going to do any of that. And then I ended up, he said, we're going to have to come back to school for one more year, which another student did do that. And I said, no, I'm out of here. I've been ready to leave here a long time. So I got my GED that summer. I worked at White Cloud Center at the University of Oregon Health and Science University. And I put my enrollment into Portland State to take some creative writing classes to see if I actually really did like it. And then I took all of the classes I could at Portland State, applied to the Institute of American Indian Arts, submitted my portfolio I created at PSU, and was accepted there in a creative writing program.
And you hadn't really done, I mean, as you've mentioned, writing all your life, but you hadn't put anything in for submission until that thing your senior year?
Yeah, I didn't write poetry. I hated poetry.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did you hate poetry?
Because what they taught us was archaic. And it was monocultural, I guess I could say, the canon. And it didn't include the living spirit of people, in my opinion. It was like the context within the people that we were studying didn't appeal to me.
Old white guys, essentially.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if that's the exact feeling.
I'm being crude
had.
Here, I understand, but yeah.
No, I think, you know, like I was an avid reader. I've read worldwide literature, you know. I mean, it wasn't like I was an ignorant high school student. I just read everything I could get my hands on. The librarian used to actually order books for me to read that year. He'd say, well, these are all the books that I ordered. You know, I'd go through the list and I'd pick what I wanted to read. And he said, I think you'd like this one. And I said, yeah, I would. And I will. I went back to high school to do a workshop a couple of times. And I went into the library and I pulled out these books that I knew that I had read. And I was the last person that checked them out. And I was the only person that checked them out.
Ever?
Ever. You know, my signature's in those books.
Uh-huh. And tell us about some of those books.
Well, like I said, Leslie Marmon Silko and Scott Mamadé. Okay. There was a rack of, you know, contemporary literature because most of the contemporary works were, you know, kept separate from the standard library. And I also, you know, read a lot in the Multnomah County Library and I could order books that way. But I had started my own library like when I was in second grade and I've always had a library.
Your own shelf of books at home?
I do have some. I'm going to be getting rid of them. I actually sold a major collection of first edition Native American authors throughout my lifetime. Uh-huh. I've collected a large amount of that. So that's in the Wilson Room at the Multnomah County Library.
How big a collection had it grown to be?
I don't know. I can't really tell you how many volumes. That's the kind of thing that I don't think about. But
I think in terms of shelf space, like, you know, 4 feet, 6 feet.
No, I don't know because, you know, every event I've gone to since 1983, I've purchased books from authors and had them sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point I had a leak in my roof and I saw that there was, you know, water damage in this, where I kept my library. So I just packed all those books and said, you know, I need to get these into a certain collection. And then Jim Carman and I were friends or we got to know each other. And he said that they were purchasing and they want to get every single Native American author's book in the special collection there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, I can give you a good deal on this whole load of books I have. And, you know, I could have sold some of them for, you know, big bucks if I had done it in a different route. But it would be in this library. I can go visit them. I can go read them.
Mm-hmm.
And other people can. And then also I had like a whole collection of manuscripts. I even had Leslie Marmon Silko's draft of Almanac of the Dead. I didn't sell it to Jim. I gave that back to the person who had lent it to me. And I said, you know, you probably want to keep this. And she said, oh, my God.
I didn't
know you had it.
How long had you had it?
Many years. But she, you know, basically had given it to me because I couldn't wait.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Almanac of the Dead is a huge book. This was a huge galley. Mm-hmm. This was the galleys.
Oh, all right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
The manuscript.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Elizabeth Woody, the Oregon Poet Laureate here on the Jefferson Exchange, and having a great conversation here, but I would like for the audience to hear some of your poetry.
Okay.
I put a couple pieces in front of you, so if you can pick one of those and tell us what you'll be reading.
All right, I'm going to read a poem in the homeless, and it's based in Portland. I lived many, many years in Portland, and 28 years in one apartment, and there were a lot of traffic between the industrial area and to Ladd's Addition, where people would go back and forth and get cans and, you know, collect the things they needed to try and get, you know, money. And oftentimes they'd come into our backyard and look for cans. And so this is kind of about that experience. The buildings are worn. The trees are strong and ancient. They bend against the grid of electric lines. The windows are broken by the homeless and the cold past. I am home on the yard that spreads mint, pales the Victorian roses, takes into it the ravaged lilac tree. The black bulk of plastic lies about, stopping unwanted weeds for the landlord. Tattered, the cedar tree is chipped to dry heaps of recklessness. The unwanted spreads by the power of neglect. The wear traffic says, we are out of time, must hurry. Age, the creak in the handmade screen door, fades behind itself.
Elizabeth Woody, reading The Home and the Homeless here on the Jefferson Exchange. She is Oregon's Poet Laureate. Portland, where you wrote that, certainly has had an experience with homeless people for many years now, and it seems to be unchanging over time.
Yeah, well, this book was published in 1994, so that poem might have been written in between 1988 and 1990. And there, of course, you know, as 57 years that I've been alive, there has not been a big change in homeless population, in my opinion. I've always noticed the homeless in Portland, the camps, the fact that, you know, people are living in their cars. I mean, I was very aware of it because I was not too far from that myself. And in fact, when I first came back from Santa Fe, I didn't have a place to live. And this was during the Reaganomics era, and there weren't any jobs. And so I stayed in a single room occupancy and ate in soup kitchens and went to food banks and wrote my first book of poems, finished my first book of poems, Hand into Stone, by typing on a Black Rattle typewriter at my mother's place. And going back to my single room occupancy and just being a Portland nut, I guess. Weirdo. Is that what they say? Keep Portland weird?
Keep Portland weird. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your mother, Charlotte. A bumpy experience in her life, I understand. And she died about a year and a half ago, but still managed to be there for you at important times in your life, it sounds
like. Yeah. Well, my mom and I have a very strong relationship with my mother. I mean, had a strong one, but also with my aunt Lillian Pitt and my uncle Louis Pitt. They were kind of like, I had like the benefit of having biological parents. I had my intellectual parents, which were Lillian Pitt and Louis Pitt, brother and sister, and my grandparents were my spiritual parents, and they were the ones who raised me in Madras. And so I like to say that I had the benefit of three people there. But my mom was a radical activist in the 70s and took us to a lot of things and events in Portland that people tell me are not, you know, that a lot of people don't know about. We had a house in Portland that was that kind of took over from some friends that were kind of like had a nuclear family, not a nuclear family, but a core family of people who really wanted to change the world. And when they went on, we kept it, and it became the AIM House in Portland, which is American Indian Movement. And, you know, we had the FBI outside our house 24/7.
Oh, this is the COINTELPRO days,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my mom would do things like go take them coffee, and she fixed their car one time. And my sister would give them the peace sign every time we went in and out. And it was just a constant that we knew. And then, of course, when we'd leave town, our cars would be searched.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, and my sister and I were little kids. And we had to basically endure that kind of surveillance and the phone surveillance. And so I kind of grew up with another type of America, I think, and a different type of Native America as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of an urban Native America with FBI overtones. We're talking about Elizabeth Woody's life here on the Jefferson Exchange. She's Oregon Poet Laureate, and she's visiting Ashland for a speaking event this afternoon at 4 at Southern Oregon University's Hannon Library in the Meese Room. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Ned in Phoenix writes that I believe Sarah Winnemucca is the perfect person to place on the $20 bill. For one, she's Native American, who should be replacing Andrew Jackson on the bill for obvious reasons. Secondly, she's a woman who fits the criteria of popular demand. What do you think about that? Sarah Winnemucca on the 20 instead of Andrew Jackson.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Sarah Winnemucca was an amazing person. She was. She didn't make her fame by killing people.
Well, as Andrew Jackson
yeah,
did.
Yeah.
It's interesting to get. I don't know. Do you notice over the course of your life greatly changed perspectives on people who were presented as heroes in our history books growing up?
Well, I think there's been a lot of work done intellectually and through scholarship that brings things to the forefront that hadn't been there before. Most of the assumption was, I think, that, you know, America was an empty land, because, as you may have noticed growing up, that Indians are always put in the Natural History Museum, not in the other, you know, as a, not as a civilization, but we were like animals. And so I think that that has changed a lot. Now they have contemporary American Indian art in museums. Before there weren't any. So, yeah, it's changed.
Talk about the process of writing poetry. Is it a daily practice for you still? I mean, do you spend a lot of time on it?
No, I don't really spend a lot of time on it right now, because I have to make, you know, make a living. I think the most productive time of writing poetry happened when I was a professor at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and I was teaching writing, living writing, breathing writing, communicating and talking with other writers, contemporary writers. So it's a lot to do with the environment. It has a lot to do with being able to afford to do it. You know, that's the other part that I think. I don't have the support of an institution. I don't have the support of a spouse. I don't have the support of all of these different things that some of the poets I know do have, artists I know do have.
Do you even get a stipend as the poet laureate of Oregon?
Okay. Yeah, but you get the stipend, but you spend it on your travel expenses and you get reimbursed.
Ah.
It's a $10,000 stipend, $10,000 transportation stipend. So you get the $10,000, so you have the money in hand so that you can pay for the expenses of traveling all over Oregon. And then you get reimbursed the money from the $10,000 that's been allocated. And oftentimes you don't spend it all, but that's the way it is.
Okay, so nobody's going to get rich being Oregon's poet laureate.
No, but, you know, I do make a living. I do have honorariums. I do ask for stipends at other instances that would help me and has helped me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of your other occupational stuff, though, too, because you as we mentioned at the outset of the program, you spent a long time at EcoTrust, and some of the best material about you on the web comes from a piece that Bob Hicks put on the EcoTrust website. What is EcoTrust, and what did you do there?
When I started at EcoTrust, I was part of the development team, and I was a program associate for the economic development and the development, which are two different things. The development is raising money. And when I first was offered the job at EcoTrust, it was by Arthur Dye. He wanted to have a writer become the program associate. So he spoke with Kim Stafford, who was the son of Bill Stafford. And he says, I need a really good writer. I need somebody who can think on their feet and can just, you know, do blasts. And he said, well, Elizabeth Woody's looking for a job, and she's a great writer. And he called me up out of the cold blue, and just on a cold call, and said, you don't know me. You don't know who I am. You don't know about EcoTrust. But give me 5 minutes of your time. And he did. And I got like tingles up and down my spine, because I just declared to the universe that I wanted a job that was with a socially responsible company that had a focus on salmon and trees, forest, and that another criteria was that they had to really want me. And so he offered me the position, and I went down to actually look at it, and they had raised like $25 million in the first 5 years that they were in existence back in the 80s. And I said, I can learn something from them. And then I also did with the, over the time that I was there for 12 years, I ended up being the director of the Indigenous Leadership Program, which was, which gave out $25,000 to one leader of merit and note a year. And then four smaller prizes of $5,000 to $10,000, depending on the donations, to the four finalists. And our whole mission was to promote their work, to talk about what they were doing and why it was important. And so we ended up having we didn't think about it, but 100 leaders, you know, of note and merit. And so we convinced, or Spencer convinced Howard and Peter Buffett to build the endowment, giving 250,000 each, $500,000. And then the Cargill Foundation much later added to that pot with another $250,000.
And what could the people do with the grants?
They could do anything they wanted to. It was basically they weren't required to do a report. They weren't required to do a mission or proposal. Everything was determined by what their community said about them, because they were going to continue to do their work whether they had money or not. And it was just intended to bring them some relief, because most of them had very poorly paid jobs. Some of them were doing it out of their own pocket. Clarence Alexander, I remember one year, he didn't even live in a cash economy. You know, in order for him to come and get his award, we had to set up, we had to send him cash mm-hmm. to the organization that nominated him because he didn't have a bank account. And
did he do everything through barter?
No. He actually lived in the Yukon River, mm-hmm. and the cash that they used, they would buy barrels and barrels of gasoline, and they lived on the land.
Huh. So he never had money to spend for anything.
Not in pocket money.
Not in pocket money.
Not the kind of money you need when you come to Seattle.
Sure, yeah. When you come to a big city, the economy changes drastically.
He was naive. He's an international, mm-hmm. national guy.
We have much more to talk about with Elizabeth Woody. She is Oregon's Poet Laureate, and we'll come back to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 20. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking with Oregon's Poet Laureate, and we've talked to three in a row now because Elizabeth Woody is the current holder of the position. Halfway through her two-year position, she is Elizabeth Woody. She is Oregon's first Native American Poet Laureate, a member of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, has lived in Oregon since she was 3 years old. Her poetry has long been recognized for awards, won an American Book Award back in 1990 for Hand Into Stone, and is now traveling the state of Oregon in the duties of the Poet Laureate. Will appear this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Meese Room at the Hannon Library on the Southern Oregon University campus, brought in by FHL, the Friends of the Hannon Library. You can join our conversation with Elizabeth Woody here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned the extensive travel and that you haven't gotten to far eastern Oregon yet, but how many miles do you think you've put on just in the year already?
Well, quite a bit. You know, I've been to Pendleton twice, La Grande, Eugene, Salem. I haven't been to the coast yet. I do have some requests in, but I like to congregate or to kind of put all my visits together if I can in different locations. So sometimes I'll do two or three things in a week, and hopefully next year I'll be doing more schools.
When you make your events, when you do your events, I mean, obviously people want to hear your poetry, mm-hmm. but what do you do to encourage other people to present theirs?
I don't. I mean, it's not part of the job. I'm mm-hmm. going out there and reading poetry and talking to people about different things. It just depends. When I'm at university, it's part of the Indian Country Today series that I read there, and basically that's to give the students and give their community access to lecturers who normally wouldn't come to Salem. One year, I'm on their Native American Council, so one year they brought in Hank Adams and Billy Frank Jr., who is one of they're both major icons from the 70s, mm-hmm. Seminoles. So...
All right, so while we're on the subject of salmon, this is a good time to get into a poem you wrote called She Who Watches, and I wonder if you'd read that for us.
Sure. I'd like to preface it a little bit. David's so happy. He's been getting a lot of press lately. He's gone. He was jailed for selling, I think, 50 salmon, whereas there were corporations that had sold tons of salmon that were never prosecuted or jailed.
And he was hauled in a sting operation, essentially.
Yeah, it was a sting, a salmon scam, they called it. And then he ended up being put into prison. And the first prison, I can't remember exactly where it was, he had been so well-liked that they moved him again to a prison that was farther away, back towards Minnesota or someplace. And just because it was punishment for him. And he was also an Indian doctor. He's a member of the Columbia River Plateau tribes. So I knew him through my my grandfather's work in medicine, Indian doctoring. The other thing that I probably should talk about is Celilo Falls, and Celilo Falls was inundated in 1956, and the village at one point had all of these really run-down old army barrack shacks, and the longhouse was kind of dilapidated, so they've been rebuilt.
Mm.
since then. For David So Happy, April 25th, 1925 to May 7th, 1991, She Who Watches the Names Our Prayer. My humanness is an embellished tongue. The bellow yellow mouth of September's moon beats outward. She speaks for all the names that cling in memorial. There is Solilo, dispossessed, the village of neglect and bad structure. The falls are faint rocks and rippled in the placid lake of backwaters. With a sad stone grief and wisdom, I overlook the railroad, the tight bands rail along the whirls of the Columbia. Drowning is a sensation fishermen and their wives know of, men who fished son after father. There are drownings in the jails and off-reservation suicide towns. A strange land awaits the fishermen, as it had for the Nez Perce, the Navajo, the Cheyenne, those who wailed in the long walks, keened open the graves of their families, the dead children, my children, with names handed down and unused. The people, pure in emergence, the immense mothers crying, human beings. The words are tremors in the ribcage of hills. The consumption of loneliness binds us. Children lie on the railroad tracks to die from the wail of night and spirits. I watch for the rushing head of chaos, and flat hands grope from the cattle cars, clamor in the swift, fresh air. A sky is clicking through the regular slats. The tail whips the dusty battles of the Indian Wars, unsettling itself nude and raw. Solilo falls sank unwillingly in the new trading, and everyone dissolved from the fall. Now, the long walks were pretty, when I'm talking about the long walks, the Nez Perce were, of course, forced to go to Oklahoma. The Navajos were forced to go to Bosque Redondo. The Cheyenne, of course, were taken to Oklahoma and had made several valiant escapes from basically what was imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to find out that the Wasco Lala people in the Columbia River were also forced to walk from the Columbia River to Warm Springs and to carry only what they could.
And the tribes from the Rogue River country were forced to walk to
yes.
Sillettes.
Right? Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So there's been many instances of it. And this is just, you know, at this time when I wrote the poem, I didn't know that. The history was, history is always told from the view of the conqueror. And one thing that my uncle always reminds me of, he says, we were not conquered. We were just oppressed and forced to give up a lot of our nationhood through the treaties. But everything that is not mentioned in the treaties, for example, for the Confederate Tribes of Warm Springs, are retained. We are sovereign nations.
And it's not just that the people were forced to move, but that the land itself was changed. I mean, the Solilo Falls story is a fairly common one in the sense that, you know, people, we dam up rivers all the time and submerge things. I mean, there's no falls in Klamath Falls anymore, for example.
Yeah.
Solilo, though, I mean, it's so central to the Columbia Plateau Indians, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think it was central to a lot of people. It was this mega center for trade. Trade networks went all across the Americas and down to South America. And it was one of the places that things would go through in order to get up north to BC, up, you know, East Coast, West Coast, anywhere. All of the roads out of Solilo led to another trade center.
I remember the first time I saw pictures of people fishing at Solilo Falls and thought, wow, that looks really cool. Mm-hmm. Where is that? And I realized it's behind a dam now.
Yeah.
And under a lake.
Yeah.
Not there. Well, what would you like to see happen to restore or make good for the loss of the falls?
Well, one of the things that's really important is the education that people need, that the land itself has a history that's probably it's significant, you know, that people understand that the river, Columbia River, is not an energy producer. It's not an egg. It's not a water for agriculture. It's not a transportation system, but it's a major ecosystem. The Columbia River is like the third or fourth largest river in North America. The volume of water that comes through the Columbia River is like second in the nation. So there's just certain things that people don't know about the landscape that they live in, and also that there's a prehistory that we all share that they need to understand. So for me, the absence of Solilo is not necessarily an absence, but it's the recollection, the memory, the understanding of it that's missing. Mm-hmm. So Confluence Project actually has, who I'm working with Confluence on, a myelin installation that's going to be out at Salila Park.
What kind of installation?
Monumental one.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're talking big artwork,
yeah,
big sculpture.
Yeah, big sculpture. Myelin actually has several others that have been placed by Confluence in different locations in the Northwest and Snake River, mouth of the river. And you can go on the website and look at all of the different projects. This is the last one that hasn't been completed. And it's the best way to describe it is it's a long arcing walkway that goes from the park over the river, and along the way is going to be the descriptions and narrative of Salilo. And there's going to be interpretive materials there, and that people will be able to be part of that place. And someday the dam will come down, and someday there'll be a different landscape there. We don't know if there will be another Salila Falls, but it was never destroyed. It was never bombed. And like they'd said, people had said that. But
So it has not been dynamited out, yeah, for
no.
example. Yeah.
But the silt and the mud and the junk that's in the backwaters of the dam has to leave before there could ever be a Salilo again.
Mm-hmm. But you think that day will come?
The dams don't last forever.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It could be a very long view, though. Tom, you write essays and short fiction, too. And, mm-hmm. and you mentioned you don't write poetry very much anymore. So of your recent writing, what has been the bulk of it?
Essays.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have probably 500 pages of essays that need to be kind of collected. And I need to go back and remove some redundancies. I do have some fiction that I've been looking at again for the first time in a long time, and started out as these characters that were kooky and how to move them from A to Z. It's kind of fun.
It is. You have so many skills and talents, and again, I mentioned I think that you have a master's degree in public administration. We talked about your work at EcoTrust, but you're also a program coordinator for CMOP, the Center for Coastal Margin Observation and Prediction. What is that?
Oh, well, I worked there for 3 years. I was actually working in a K-12 education program that mm-hmm. they had, and their Science and Technology Center, they received granting funding for 7 years from Congress, and they found these science and technology centers to do kind of unique and novel projects, and it's up to them to find funding for further on. And so when I worked with them, I just wanted to work with the kids, and we did.
Teaching them about what? About coastal wetlands and things like that?
It's a near coast ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I did as a project was I stayed for 9 months at the NEA Indian Center, Early College Academy. And I worked with a science teacher, Stephanie Kelly, and we did designed a curriculum that could be implemented 1 week a month that would incorporate or pull in the biologists, scientists, projects, people from the community to come in and work with the kids that were in the academy. And their first year that we did it, we were building towards designing and building a bioswale as a possible career choice for them with And then we also took them out into the Columbia River estuary on a canoe.
When I look at all of the interests and education you have, I guess what I come back to is I wonder if people should stop being surprised when someone like you has so many skills and talents and actually uses them. I mean, do you think people are too quick to just say, well, I'm a whatever, and leave it at one thing?
Yeah, I think so. I was on a panel with Sharon Olds and Marie Howe, or not Marie Howe. Yeah, it was Marie Howe. And they said, what would you do if you couldn't write poetry? And Sharon Old said, I'd die immediately. And Marie Howe said, oh, I don't know. She was, I forget what she'd said. But then I just said, I'd find something else I could do really well and enjoy, and I'd do it. You know, it's you continue to live.
Mm-hmm.
You can't stop yourself. And I also feel that people get focused on one thing. And we're kind of in a new age of information. So being able to access massive amounts of information, being able to utilize it is really important. Being creative, being able to for example, think outside of what normal people in the workplace think of. Because I like to find solutions. If something's impeding the accomplishment of the work we need to do, we need to stop that and figure out how to make it work.
What do you think you'll do when your next year of poet laureateness is up?
I don't know. I'm looking for employment, one thing, and then the other is I might spend some time. Well, I've been spending time in Warm Springs, so I've been reconnecting with my roots and my family. So there's certain things there that I've been thinking about that might help me get to the next plateau in terms of my own professional development. Professional development isn't just work. It's being able to, like, for example, write new books.
Mm-hmm.
I might do that. I don't know. I have a real need to connect back to the land. The Sockeye have come back to Blue Lake. They've come back to the Deschutes River. The landlocked Kokanee have escaped to the ocean and come back, which is major.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd like to spend time. This is what I do. I go out there and I observe, I learn, I listen, talk to people. I get questions in my head and then I just follow it.
Wow. That's a really interesting experience that you've had through life. And we really appreciate you sharing it with us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Elizabeth Woody is Oregon's Poet Laureate. Her appearance in Ashland is today at 4 at the Meese Room. That's on the third floor of the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University's campus, brought to town by the Friends of the Hannon Library. Again, Elizabeth Woody, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.